We have one case on our oral argument calendar today. Marshall, do you want to call the court to order and call our case?
Yes, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Riley, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding. Calling case 822-0717 in the matter of the civil commitment of Russell John Hatton.
Great. Well, welcome this morning. And I know you're all experienced Zoom oral argument litigators. An audio recording of this argument will be available online after. So with that in mind, please introduce yourselves at the start of your argument. And as you know, also, appellant has 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, and respondent has 15 minutes in between. And with that, please proceed. Mr. Winter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Winter. I am representing the appellant, the Commissioner of Human Services in this case. And as I'm sure Your Honors know, this is a CAP case. The issue is the CAP granted the transfer. The commissioner is asking for Mr. Hatton's transfer grant to be reversed. Now, I think we have, at least in my experience, relatively unique situation in this case, in that we have a reported case that is has an identical or almost identical procedural posture, has an extremely similar set of factual circumstances, and that's the Edwards case, matter of civil commitment of Edwards, 933 Northwest 2nd, 796. And I hope that I don't bore everyone by saying Edwards over and over again, but it really is an extremely on point case, both factually and in terms of the legal issues that are at play. So the main difference being in the commissioner's view that Mr. Hatton is a somewhat less meritorious candidate for transfer than Mr. Edwards was in the case in which this court reversed a grant to transfer under the applicable standard of review. So that standard of review, contrary to, I think, Mr. Hatton's position, and I suspect also the CAP's position in granting this transfer, is not akin to something like in a criminal case where there is a sufficiency of the evidence standard, where if there's anything that could possibly have been believed by the jury in that kind of situation.
So, Mr. Winter, I'm going to interrupt you real quickly.
Sure.
I'll try to keep my question quick here. So the statute talks just the five factors. The statute just talks about, it says that they must be considered. And so the CAP here, you know, thinks they considered it and they found that three of the factors, weigh in favor of the transfer. And so, and it's not outweighed by the other two. And so we're going to grant the transfer. So why is that wrong?
It's wrong because it's true that they said that three of the factors were met. I think they said that there was ample evidence that they were met. The problem is they didn't actually tie that legal conclusion or mixed conclusion of law and fact to the actual evidence as a whole in the record, which is what they are.
But so are you focusing on the infractions for the protests and then the tracing paper? I mean, is that what you're basing this on? I mean, that part of it on 2, 3, and 5.
That is part, I wouldn't say I'm focusing on it. That's part of the argument. But I can tell you what I am identifying as evidence that the CAP did not properly consider, and as evidence that on this court standard of review shows that the evidence as a whole is against transfer. And what that is in part the behavioral infractions, because that's relevant to the need for continued security to accomplish continuing treatment, which is factor number two. The other thing that the CAP didn't consider and on which there was unrebutted evidence is that, And I want to be really clear about this concept with the panel because it's not, I don't think it's intuitive. One of the things that we talk about in these cases is the need for, and there's some of this in the record and in the briefing, but the need for external controls over a person versus a committed person versus internal controls. And what people like Chris Schiffer and Ms. Sexy testify to is that CPS is designed for people who have gone far enough in treatment to develop internal controls where they don't need external security. Now, that's a different, the security there has a different value than, you know, protecting someone from running away or preventing someone from physically assaulting someone, right? The value there.
But it's a behaviorally, though, I mean, just on those issues, behaviorally, that he was respectful. You know, there's the one time he was, you know, during the tour of new employees said, you know, you shouldn't be working here. You've got blood on your hands. But other than that, there's no evidence, or did I miss it, of him acting aggressively towards others, misbehaving in terms of actual behavior. You know, being aggressive, violent, etc.
So the behavioral infractions that are, there are some, I think that to answer the question more directly, I think what you're stating underplays it somewhat. There is evidence that I think that is verbal aggression. I think that there are other instances of him refusing to comply with staff directives in terms of refusing to leave a yard. There's a situation in which he tried to solicit a vulnerable adult for donations to the brain coach individual that he says is running his treatment. And those are pretty serious things. I agree with you. I think what we can say about Mr. Hatton that's favorable, and this is about the only thing we can say about him that's favorable, is that he hasn't physically assaulted anyone and that there isn't evidence that he would abscond if a razor wire isn't, you know, placed around. Mm-hmm. And certainly those two facts are relevant to factor five of the transfer factors. Now, I can anticipate a question then in which one says, well, what about, you know, why can't the cap give significant weight to that? And I think the answer to that is twofold. One is we can read the statute and it, in my view, that would not be effectuating the intent of the legislature to say that they intended transfer only for people that aren't going to run away or only for people that aren't assaulting folks. But again, I can also come back to Edwards, in which there was a situation in which it was true that it's not all of the factors that weighed against the person. But again, we have a preponderance burden on the individual who is trying to transfer.
Mr. Winter, what do we do with Ms. Sexy's testimony that CPS has similarly situated clients as Mr. Hatton? And well, people who haven't progressed past level one in their treatment, and CPS has been able to work with those people.
I don't think that there's any disagreement that it is theoretically possible for a phase one client to go to CPS without some kind of disaster ensuing. And of course, it is true that when they get there, MSOP will do what they can to try to work with the person. So again, it's not the commissioner's burden, though, to show that it is somehow impossible for that to occur. The question under the statutory factors is that the best place, or under the relevant statutory factor to that question, is that the best place for treatment to be accomplished?
And let me ask you this. Say we were to affirm the order and he does go to CPS, what's the worst thing that could happen? Let's say that he doesn't fulfill the benefit of the doubt that various people have said they're giving to him, and he doesn't succeed there. Doesn't he just go back to the MSOP program then? What happens?
He certainly could. If the revocation, we're talking about the factors under subdivision one in 0.29, the revocation is related and it's in subdivision three. But if he were to engage in behavior or lack of behavior, I suppose the merited revocation, that's a possibility. And I get that that fact is sort of a practical consequence. That being said, the statutory factors don't say, the statutory factors do not merit and they do not justify what was frankly Dr. Doherty's approach here and the CAPS approach, which is, as I said in the brief, this sort of roll the dice, let's hope for the best, benefit of the doubt type approach. If it did, basically everyone would transfer to CPS, and then with the understanding that if something serious happened, there would be a revocation. The legislature could have set it up that way, and it just didn't. They have the burden to show, on the whole record, by a preponderance, that the transfer is affirmatively appropriate.
So on factor four, though, it seems like the CAP was saying, well, he's not progressing on his sex offender treatment within the secure perimeter. He's now at least said he'll really consider, I guess his testimony is, yes, he will participate. So if he goes to CPS, so isn't CPS then the facility that can best meet his needs if he says he'll cooperate with treatment there? And I get the problem with the disincentive of, you know, if you reward somebody by, you know, a step down in security by not cooperating, then that seems, you know, then nobody will go through treatment. I mean, they'll just wait. But
right.
But other than that, though, I mean, in looking at that question of what can best meet, and then the overall constitutional standard of least restrictive alternative, why not CPS?
Well, so a few things. Aside from the incentive thing, which you've identified, the answer is that I can imagine a situation in which there is testimony where somebody says, look, I've examined this person's treatment needs, and this kind of high security area is just really bad for this particular kind of guy in light of what's going on with him, right? And the CPS place, even though he's not progressing through treatment, that's going to be a good place for him because that's the kind of place he'll respond to. That is not, however, what happened in this case. What happened in this case is they said, well, you know, and basically it's a guy who's said, I'm not going to have anything to do with treatment for many, many years, no matter what, because he doesn't believe that the treatment program is sound. He doesn't believe that he has any problems, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we've got from Dr. Doherty, and then following on that, what we've got from the CAP is a hope. It's explicitly stated as a hope, right? It isn't saying there was evidence that this is a better place for him. What they're saying is, and Dr. Doherty said this, he doesn't know what's going to happen if Mr. Hatton goes to CPS. He's just kind of hoping for the best. And that's the problem with the CAPS approach and with Dr. Doherty's approach in light of what the statute says.
Okay. So can I ask you to focus on the standard of review here for a minute? So Edwards answered the question that for findings of fact, we use clear error. But then it expressly left open the issue of, well, when we get to the point, okay, we've got the findings, there's no clear error in the findings, then you move on to the application of the five factors. And is that abuse of discretion such that, you know, unless we find that the panel misapplied the law, or that it's against logic, I think that logic and the facts on record or something is the abuse of discretion standard. Is that the standard we're to apply then to the CAPS application of the law to the facts that the panel's found?
No, the way that I understand Edwards, Edwards, I should say, specifically in combination with the later Kenny case from the Supreme Court in 2021, is that the whole standard of review is clear error. And what that means...
What does that mean, though, when you're talking about application of the law? That's my question.
Yeah.
Because usually clear error applies to findings of fact. And that's where quite honestly, it gets kind of muddled, but go ahead.
Well, I think that I don't know how to answer except to say that I think that Kenny is saying it's all clear error in the way that, and then I can sort of try to understand what that means in terms of legal application to the factors by observing how Edwards does it and how Kenny does it. And what they do, and these cases are inherently they can be very fact intensive. But what those cases do is they, I think, treat the factors as relatively straightforward in terms of which facts apply to which factor, and then ask, and this is what I'm asking the court to do here, and then ask, or basically say, we're going to consider the record as a whole, with the record as a whole being composed of all the testimony that was not rebutted or, shown to be sort of reasonably in question, and make a decision about whether that supports the overall decision. Here it transfer one, and here it does not, consistent with Edwards.
Mr. Winterwood, do you agree that that's a higher burden on the appellant than it typically is with an abuse of discretion if it's clear error all across the board?
I don't think so. I apologize. I just haven't read an explicit explanation of abuse of discretion recently, but I think that in combination with the preponderance burden being on the petitioner, and then reaching the clear error standard here, it doesn't allow reweighing of evidence. It doesn't allow the questioning of credibility determinations, but it does allow this court to look at what the cap did, and it does allow the court to say, as it did in Edwards, that the cap isn't allowed to ignore unrebutted bad evidence. And that.
But then, what do we do with the cap's finding that Dr. Doherty was more credible than Dr. Mack? We're not going to substitute our credibility determination.
Right. And I don't ask your honors to substitute that credibility determination so much as I'm asking your honors to review what Dr. Doherty actually said and how the cap's sort of deployment of that credibility determination about him misstates what he said. What he did was he nominally supported transfer, but which doesn't in itself have any value or any more value than someone saying, look, I support Mr. So-and-so's transfer because he just seems like a nice guy. What they have to say in order to have evidentiary value is to tie that support to evidence that relates to the statutory factors. And that's what Dr. Doherty didn't do, with the exception of observing that Mr. Hatton probably isn't going to run away and probably isn't going to punch anyone. But other than that, he didn't really have much favorable to say other than let's roll the dice and see what happens. I see my time has been up, so I would reserve the rest for rebuttal unless there are further questions.
Further questions? Nope. All right. Thank you, Mr. Winter.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Biglow.
And good morning. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Mike Biglow. I'm attorney of record for the respondent, Mr. Russell John Hatton. Respondent, we are responding to commissioner's suggestion that the CAP panel is in error. I just wanted to, I'm not going to restate my brief here. I just have some comments I'd like to make. There's a television show on PBS. It's called The Red Green Show. There's a segment called The Repair Shop. At the beginning of every segment, Red Green says, if it ain't broke, you're not trying. And I think the appellant's position is that wants this court to take a look at a perfectly fine decision at the CAP level and start questioning findings, conclusions, and orders that the commissioner just doesn't agree with. Comment on factors. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Bigelow, yes. Actually, I'd like to stop you there because I'm not sure if I agree with that assessment, because for our standard of review, we do look at whether the record supports the evidence in the record supports the decision that's made by the CAP. And I have to admit, I'm a little concerned about what evidence there is in the record to support the CAP's decision, especially given that it explicitly said that it wasn't considering certain evidence when it needs to consider all relevant evidence. My question to you is, what is the specific evidence that supports the CAP's decision with respect to the factors, including that CPS is the best location, and perhaps more importantly, the lack of clinical progress that appellant made?
Yes, thank you for that question. Now, respondent hasn't been sitting idly all these years. He did start programming back in 2008. He was in programming for 5 years, and then he was not advanced. He was concerned about the sporadic nature of group sessions, chemical dependency classes that were discontinued, CD counselors no longer available. He wasn't advanced. It's not his decision. It's the program's decision. So,
I may take issue with you there, because the testimony and evidence was that most people can progress through phase one fairly rapidly. It's not that hard. And so, to me, it shows the level of engagement that he had with regard to phase one that it dragged on so long and then he quit.
This is an individualized treatment program that should meet the individual's treatment needs. And this is, again, in the context of the Karjgin's case, that was already started. So there was already this.
But that's not relevant to his progress here. We understand that may have given him hope he was going to get, you know, that may have impacted his decision making. But I mean, phase one, it seems like he is still to this day not recognizing that he has an issue. I mean, that's sort of the beginning of phase one work, isn't it? So where is the progress there? And does Dr. Doherty really say that he's made clinical progress? Is that his opinion? I mean, it seems like the CAP may be stretching that a bit. That he's saying, well, he's made personal progress. He's got this, you know, kind of a schedule, and he's learned a lot about neuroscience, and he's done these other things. But in terms of clinical sex offender treatment progress, he hasn't made any. And as a matter of fact, even Dr. Doherty says, I have no basis to even be able to evaluate empirically where he is because he hasn't been participating. So how do we deal with that piece of this?
Well, he has in fact been utilizing programs from MSOP. He did testify, and there's evidence that he participates in recreational programming, yoga programming. He's mentoring peers. He's been connected with educational programming there since 2008 or 2009.
So one of the things that troubles me most about your client's testimony is that he denied offending against CSN and DMN. And the record is that DMN was 12 years old. He was 16 at the time that he started having sex with her. And she went on to have 4 babies with him, including one at 14. And I don't know how he denies that when there's such direct proof of it.
Thank you. And that programming will continue at Community Preparation Services. It's not a different program, it's just the location of the program.
So, but what programming? He hasn't completed any programming, and you're listing programs, but are those really relevant to the issue of sex offender treatment, of him addressing the issues that and even acknowledging what he did. I'm really struggling. And you know, as Chief Judge Siegel points it out, even Dr. Doherty, he testified that in his opinion, appellant did not meet all the statutory transfer factors, including the clinical progress and the continuing treatment needs. And he said that there's really nothing there for him to even evaluate. How he didn't even make it out of the first phase in MSOP. How I'm struggling as to what is the basis to support CAP's decision on these factors. And I want to go back to the clinical progress. Has he made any clinical progress, measurable progress, as to his issues with being a sex offender?
And so the other side of the coin I was talking about, not only participating, but also changes in respondent that were recognized by the court's examiner. Protective factors, a number of protective factors were recognized, and that relates to risk. Also managed risk factors were noted, and also strengths. So protective factors cited all the time by risk assessors, especially Dr. Mack. Empathy, coping, self-control, work, leisure activities, financial management, motivation for treatment, awareness of need for treatment, significant time and energy pursuing treatment, life goals, social network, professional care, living circumstances, and external control. So these are all protective factors that the court examiner did cite that Mr. Hatton, the respondent, has achieved. He's also cited managed risk factors, significant social influences such as hostility towards women, general social rejection, lack of concern for others, impulsivity, sex drive and sex preoccupation, and sexist coping. These are things noted by the court's examiner after reviewing.
Are you talking about Dr. Doherty?
Yes, the court's examiner, yes.
Okay, where is that in the record? Because I thought looking at his analysis of the statutory factors, he said, I'm going to quote this here because I think it's relevant. Dr. Doherty said, quote, his progress is largely unmeasurable by any commonly accepted clinical or empirical means and has yet to be tested over an extended period of time relative to his lifetime functioning across a variety of high-risk situations. So you're listing a number of things, but he specifically said that he could not measure his progress by any accepted clinical or empirical means. If he can't measure that, what is the basis for CAP's conclusion that he has indeed made progress when the very expert that CAP is relying on has said, I can't measure his clinical progress? That seems to be a significant gap. Are you saying that Dr. Doherty's statement there is erroneous, or?
Well, I think
that he can't measure the progress, his clinical progress.
I think the court can take parts of an expert's opinion and rely on various findings within a report, a general statement about unable to measure, that may not disqualify or erase all the things that the court examiner has said about respondent and what respondent has achieved these many years, these 14 years at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Dr. Doherty acknowledges that he has made overall personal growth. And the factors you're citing to me appear to go to personal growth. But what we're talking about in terms of the statutory factors are clinical progress. And in terms of clinical progress, Dr. Doherty seemed to be very, very clear he couldn't measure it because he didn't see any clinical progress. So while CAP credited Dr. Doherty's testimony, I'm struggling with where is the actual evidentiary support that appellant has made clinical progress when the very report they're relying on says, from Dr. Doherty says, I couldn't measure. There wasn't any clinical progress to measure. What is the clinical, not personal growth, but actual clinical progress in the record to support the CAP's decision?
I would argue that clinical it should be used a little more broadly than maybe the court examiner is suggesting or that the court might be suggesting.
But aren't there tools that they use to measure it?
Well, they're all things that are measured at MSOP. In fact, you can be there and they call it a therapeutic environment. And so they're measuring all the time, interaction between peers and staff. So they're always measuring.
Okay, let's take it a step at a time. What about the fact that he never made it through phase one in MSOP? Isn't that part of the clinical measurement?
Right, but it would not be a disqualifier to be transferred to community preparation services. I mean, if that was the only thing you looked at, then nobody from phase one would be able to transfer.
What about his statement that he didn't think he needed any treatment?
Well, that might have been an old statement, an old perspective. But once he learned and was allowed to connect with people at CPS, he was more enlightened as to the hope and the programming that occurs there and the community environment. So he's wanting a treatment. He's wanting to progress in treatment.
Judge Reyes, did you have a follow-up? Otherwise, I've got one more.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you, Chief.
So I'm going to ask you the same question about how we apply, A, what is the standard of review, and B, how we apply that when we're talking about not the findings of fact, but the application of the criteria, the statutory criteria to the findings of fact. And what is that standard? And then is it appropriate for the CAP to say, oh, we think he's got factors 2 and 3, not 1, 4, and 5, but he gets to go? I mean, is that a preponderance of the evidence? And would that satisfy it?
Well, factors, again, it's what the court views at the time regarding that particular patient, regarding the requested reduction in custody. And obviously the CAP panel felt, the majority did, that given maybe the minimal recognized growth that Mr. Hanton had achieved and the absence of any serious risk and his desire to continue with treatment, was appropriate and sufficient enough to indicate that he met statutory criteria for transfer to community preparation services.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions from the panel? Go ahead.
Yes, I do, if I may.
Certainly. Go ahead.
I just wanted to follow up on that comment you made in terms of continued treatment. What treatment has he been undertaking that has been provided by MNSOP that he would continue?
Well, he did participate in treatment between 2008 and 2013. So,
right, but that was 9 years ago. What treatment is he currently undergoing that he would continue?
Well, he has been meeting with a therapist. He has been
No, MNSOP treatment, not treatment from another person. That
it is a MSOP therapist he's been meeting with, and he has a connection with MSOP staff, and he's been educating himself with MSOP educational materials. So he would continue, but certainly he's more focused. He's professed his desire to focus more on a group therapy modality that community preparation services would provide.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bigelow. And Mr. Winter, proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple comments. I think overall the best way to answer the question about where Mr. Haddon was at in light of any of the factors that relates to treatment progress is that even Dr. Doherty himself, in addition to what Judge Reyes was bringing up about not being able to measure treatment progress and things like that, said that the treatment progress related factors do not weigh in his favor for transfer. And it is true that MSOP is measuring treatment progress, and it measures treatment progress in part with a phase designation. And Mr. Haddon's phase designation is phase one. And that results not from some kind of victimization, not from, I don't know what the implication by the cap is that he doesn't, that MSOP is in control of phase placement, but people move on from phase one because they do the work, because they do the relatively simple responsibilities of complying with facility rules. And Mr. Haddon has chosen not to do that, and he's chosen not to engage in treatment. And it's been about 9-10 years. With respect to standard of review, Judge Siegel, I do think it's a difficult question about if we had a case where, let's say, there was really strong evidence on three factors, not so good on two of the factors, something like that. And my only thing that I want to point out in that regard is, I don't know the answer about exactly how that relates to standard of review or how the cap is supposed to deal with that, but it isn't this case. What we have in this case is a cap that really didn't meaningfully consider the statutory factors much at all. What it said was, he's not going anywhere right now. We're hoping for the best if he goes to CPS. And that's just not, whatever the statutory factor calculus might be, that is not contemplated by the statutory factors. I struggle to understand. I'll start over. We've had this sort of push and pull about what the standard of review is that I think is mostly resolved by Kenny, but we on my side had said, you know, it's de novo once you get to mixed questions, and that was wrong pursuant to Kenny. And now what we have is sort of an attempted pull on the other side. And the problem with that is that from the import of what folks in Mr. Bigelow's position argue is essentially that the cap is effectively unreviewable. And we just know that can't be the case because there is a standard of review, but we also especially know it can't be the case because we have another case that's almost identical to this one, and it came out in the commissioner's direction in the Edwards case. So I'm asking the court to look really carefully at that. I think it answers most of the questions that arise here. And
Mr. Winter?
Yes.
I'd like to follow up on the standard of review. Sure. And so, you know, we do review the CAP's decision in terms of findings of fact to determine whether or not the record actually supports those findings. And if those findings are not supported by the record, is how I understand your argument from the brief, then those findings are erroneous. That seems to lead to the idea that we would have to reverse and remand to the CAP for reconsideration of factors, particularly in light of your argument that the CAP did not specifically exclude some evidence that is relevant that should be considered. My question is, on the standard of review, let's assume for the sake of argument that the CAP said three of the five factors are met, but two aren't. The person's clinical progress and treatment needs and whether the best facility of the person's needs are met. How are we to analyze on review as an appellate court the weighing of those factors? And I realize this question may have already been asked, but I'm struggling as to what we do. As long as the CAP considered it, do we have a deferential standard, or is it that if there are findings that are not supported, we need to reverse and remand?
It's just if there's findings that are not supported, I don't think a remand is necessary in this case. That our primary argument is that it's not, and that we have a record in front of us, and that that record does not, again, using Edwards as an example, but consistent with standard of review, that record just does not support the transfers appropriate under those factors. I think the other thing that's responsive to your question is, I want to be clear, the thing that's required is not just that the CAP says three of the factors are met. I mean, it's not sort of, I don't think you're saying this, but I wouldn't agree with any argument that it's a magic words type thing, because the CAP certainly did say in this order that there's evidence of three of the factors. The question is, when you look at all of the evidence, when you look at sort of the body of the evidence as a whole, and then look at the evidence that's unrebutted, that does not have a significant reason to question its credibility, does that body of evidence as a whole support the overall CAP decision? And as I mentioned to Judge Siegel, certainly that can get dicey if there's a lot of support for three factors and not so much for two, and there's a severity analysis of some kind maybe going on. I don't have any problem buying that in that kind of close question, there's a lot of deference for the CAP. My point here is that's just not what we're looking at. What we're looking at is a case where they didn't really consider the factors much at all, and they just did this kind of roll the dice thing.
Are you saying that the record doesn't support the other three factors that CAP said supported transfer to CPS?
I am saying that.
Okay.
If there are any other questions, I'd ask for reversal, Your Honors, and I'd thank you for your time.
Any further questions? No. Thank you both very much. Your arguments and briefing was very helpful. The case is now submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time period. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.